Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Elaine Pagels, award-winning author of The Gnostic Gospels. And we're going to talk about her newest book, Why Religion? And to learn more, you can go to Elaine-Pagels, and I'm going to spell it for you, Elaine-Pagels.com. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview about every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on Why He's a Buddhist. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And the podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on about 20 different podcast services, including Apple Podcasts, Podomatic.com, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. That's TerrenceMcNally.net. And now a quick plug for participation, and I've been doing this ever since Trump's election. Here's five organizations, five websites where you can plug in and get involved or more involved in how we resist the worst of the administration and build toward the healthy, just society we all deserve. Indivisible.us, probably the biggest national organization with about 5,000 local chapters, Indivisible.us. Then two that used to be primarily digital but are working very closely now with grassroots organizations, Move On, one word, moveon.org. That's a national organization. And couragecampaign.org. Courage Campaign, one word. That's a California organization. And finally, two that are very specific. One is 5Calls. That's the number 5 and the word calls. 5Calls.org, which tells you relevant, timely calls that you might make to your representatives because of issues that are on the dock right now. And finally, Town Hall Project, one word, townhallproject.com, which tells you when your representatives are going to be holding town halls in your area where you can go and speak directly to your representatives. And now to today's guest. Elaine Pagels successfully made the transition from writing academic papers likely to be read only by fellow scholars to bringing her ideas to the wider public, resulting in bestsellers, most notably The Gnostic Gospels, which won both the National Book Critics Circle Award and the National Book Award. A number of other popular and respected works followed over the years, but in 2018, she published something quite different. In Why Religion, A Personal Story, she weaves what she has learned about religion, its history, its contributions to culture, with her own experience responding to dual tragedies that took place a little over 25 years ago, the death of her young son, followed a year later by the death of her husband. In the book, she asks, why is religion still around in the 21st century? Why do so many people still believe? How do various traditions still shape the way people experience everything from sexuality to politics, whether they're religious or not? And most importantly, can religion help us get through the most difficult challenges we face? Elaine Pagels is credited with changing our historical image of Christianity by exploding the myth of a unified early church. A professor of religion at Princeton University, where she's taught since 1982, she's been awarded Rockefeller, Guggenheim, and MacArthur Fellowships. Pagels earned her PhD at Harvard, where she was part of a team studying the Nag Hammadi Scrolls, documents found in 1945 that shed light on early Christian debates on theology and practice. Pagels' best-selling Gnostic Gospels was based on what we were learning from those scrolls, and she followed that with The Origins of Satan, Adam, Eve, and the Serpent, Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation, and her latest, Why Religion, A Personal Story. Welcome again, Elaine Pagels, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you. I'm delighted to talk with you again. This is wonderful.
Very good. And let me tell listeners that we're recording this conversation Sunday, March 3rd, 2019. Because I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work we talk about, I usually start my interviews with a question about a person's personal path. But Elaine, this book, Why Religion, basically answers that question. So why and how did you decide to write this book?
Well, this book was a long time coming, you know, and as you say, I never thought I'd write anything like it. I love to write about the history of religion, the history of Christianity, and these amazing secret gospels that were just becoming available when I was in graduate school. It was just wonderful to find something that nobody knew about and we had no clue about, and which are transformative. But and I wrote the popular books, Terrence, because I was writing the way I'd learned to write in graduate school, you know, which is basically unintelligible. I always think of it as, sounds like it's translated badly from German. You know, that's the kind of way we were talking.
I'll tell you what, can I cut in for a second, Elaine? My wife, a few years ago, entered a very prestigious program. I won't mention which one it was, in an Ivy League graduate school. And on her, and she had been a former sitcom writer and memoirist, right? And she, her reason for going to school was, I want to get these ideas out to people in a popular fashion, right? And on her first paper, she was told, you were penalized for personal experience and metaphor.
Well, right. I mean, what else would make it interesting, right? Just make it as absolutely bland as possible. Put in all the passive verbs. It has been thought that, you know, stuff like that. So we were taught to write badly. But I wanted to write partly for our friends in New York who were artists and scientists and politicians and all kinds of maverick people who just didn't think about religion, didn't like it much, had no use for it. And so they said, why religion? Why do you do that?
And I
wanted to say, well, you know, this is pretty interesting, really. And that's a question that the wonderful scientist I married asked me the first time we sort of seriously went out together. Why do you do that? So it's not that I try to answer that question so much, although there are many ways to talk about it, but it's a programmatic question because I grew up, as you know from the book, in a family that really wasn't religious. It was culturally Protestant, but not, I mean, my father thought religion was for people who were just uneducated, you know?
Yeah.
So,
I mean, we're about 5 years different in age, but that time cover with Nietzsche's quote, God is dead, you know, there were many that said, you know, obsolete, and maybe it's about time.
It's over. Religion's over, right? And because we have science, who needs that? We have psychology. We have psychiatry. I mean, we don't need that stuff. And so I'm actually surprised at how the power of these traditions nevertheless is still having an impact. I mean, what my husband said when we first went out was, why did you write about something with impact in the real world?
Oh, my God.
And I said, well, why do you write about elementary particles? You know, I mean, they may have impact in the world, but we don't really need to know that the table is made out of elementary particles to have dinner.
Yep.
You know, so you know, that's a question that very much intrigues me. And I think it's partly because these traditions are really a huge cultural source for poetry, for music, for rituals, for stories that carry the values of various cultures, whether it's the Dinka of the southern Sudan or the Hebrews of ancient Israel or Hindus or Muslims or Buddhists. They speak to questions that aren't answered by science, which is, why do things happen that way? And does it matter? And what does it mean? And for that, we do reach for metaphors.
Yes, yes, we do.
And first-person stories, just what your wife was reaching for in her own writing.
And so this, as I say, you were sort of talking about it there, that you stopped or shifted, transformed from writing the strictly academic to writing what turned out to be phenomenally popular. But as you say, this book is a radical break from that kind of writing. And let me just tell you one thing. I don't know why, but I expected maybe a 50-50 mix of religious history and personal experience.
Yeah.
And I was surprised how much of this book is your personal story, your personal relationship to religion or to the role religion might play in our lives. And I want you to know also, and listeners, this isn't always the case. I read this book in two chunks, right? Sat down and read for X number of hours. The next day, sat down and read to the end. And the experience included a fair amount of tears. And having shared your experience of the deaths in your life, I found myself, when I would rise up from reading it, feeling a very visceral preciousness of the lives of my wife or our pets or my dear friends or my family. And so there's, you know, there's something transmitted in what you shared that was deeply touching. And one thing that I think is interesting is that the book reads, the detail, the moments of the experience reads like, you know, it could be happening yesterday, and yet it was 25 years from the time these tragedies happened till you wrote. Why is that?
Well, because the loss of our son, he was 6 years old, and my husband's death in a hiking accident happened within a year of each other, and it was so traumatic. I mean, the impact of those two together, they were my whole family, really. And I adored them both, so it was so overwhelming and shattering. Shattering was the only word I could think of, that it was like a black hole in space. I could not engage the emotions very much. Of course, I couldn't not engage them,
right.
But I couldn't really go there because the brain protects us from trauma, you know? And I just had to go on and take care of a three-month-old baby that we'd adopted and a two-year-old. So, and had to put one foot in front of the other. And besides, when certain things happen, you may not be able to deal with them at all at the time emotionally. So it was only much later. But also, you know, I thought, Terrence, that it would be kind of shocking to write in such a personal way. But I appreciate what you say because really what comes across, if the writing works, is not about me. It's about what happens to people. And at first I was really horrified that I was writing something so personal.
Mm-hmm.
But then I realized that in a way your privacy is completely protected because what it brought up for you was about your life and the people you love and the way we deal with love and survival and loss and going on. And that's really what it's about. I wanted to write about the surprise, not about grief, because everybody has grief.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not something we necessarily need to dwell on. But the surprise of being alive and well, some 25 years later, it took quite a while to have that sense of joy come back. But that it did is just amazing
yes.
to me.
You know, one thing, I teach storytelling and narrative to organizations, and one of the points I make is that the more specific the detail that you put in one of your stories, the more universal the resonance, that it's this crazy paradox. And to some extent, that's what you were just saying yourself, is that the book features details, moments, you know, experiences that are so specific, so personal, so only you could have. And yet because of that, I think, not in spite of that, but because of that, the resonance is deep and universal.
I think that's right about writing. I mean, writing is an amazing thing, as you know. I mean, you obviously love it, as I do. And part of what we love is that you write to kind of discover things. I mean, people think you write when you understand something and you're writing to communicate it. But I think we write to try to understand things that are deeply puzzling.
Yes.
I mean, that's why I write about the history of religion, because I thought it was a big puzzle. I'm not just for it, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think religion is just such a great thing. There are aspects of it that are very damaging and that damage people. For example, you know, writing about Satan, when I thought I was just writing about funny old stories about a imaginary bad guy.
Yeah, boogeyman, yeah.
Yeah, this, I mean, Satan, really, are you serious? I wasn't serious about Satan. But then it turned into a story about Christian anti-Semitism, and I thought, what? I wasn't looking for that at all.
Yeah.
I didn't even recognize it in those stories, but it is in those stories, and that's how some of them work. So that's what I mean by damage, or the way Christian and Jewish and Muslim traditions have damaged people whose sexuality is different from, you know, what these ancient texts think is the right thing. So, you know, I like to write about this stuff because these are the way we're shaped culturally, you know, even quite unconsciously. Even if you're totally not in a religious family, as I wasn't, we get shaped by these cultural patterns. So it's like knowing ourselves better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the
and
things
what we accept from those traditions and what we need to reject.
Yeah, one of the things you say is that you're you know, and it's partly how you deal with people when they hear that, you know, you write about religion or you're a professor of religion and so on. They, you know, they assume that you're a theologian, and you say, no, I'm not. I'm more a historian, a cultural historian, and it's really very much how the religious tenets or the formation and structures of the religious institutions influence culture, you know, beyond and after their moment.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly right. People assume, oh, you're a theologian, and I want to say, no, that theologians talk about God. I don't know anything about God, really. I'm talking about human culture. I'm talking about how these traditions have grown and how they shape people for better and for worse, and why sometimes I find it's valuable for me to engage them. I don't think everybody needs them. I think my husband didn't need them. He had physics, and that was his way of understanding the world, and other people focus on art and music and politics and many other things.
Yes.
This is one form of imagination, though, that I think really isn't so much about what you believe. People think religion's about, do you believe in this or that, in God or Jesus or whatever. But it's less about that than it is about how these stories and poems and songs and rituals and cultural influences affect us emotionally.
Yeah, yeah. Let me just take one example, for instance. You point out that, I will say to listeners, this is a little bit the way the book works. I'm going to tell you something about religion and culture, but it really came to you from a personal experience. You attended a conference pretty early in your studies, if I'm not mistaken, or, you know, many years ago, and they wanted you to speak about what you'd learned about women, right?
Yes, yes. So this was a feminist conference, you know, when people were talking about, you know, women a lot, particularly. And they said, well, why don't you just tell us about women in the early Christianity? So you go on.
Yeah. Well, and of course, your answer was, they said, what did you learn in you know, in your wonderful graduate school at Harvard about women? And you said, zero, nothing. There is nothing. And you point out that the Romans had and the Greeks had goddesses, and the gods had wives, and they had, you know, lives
and
mothers and so on.
And lovers.
And that, that what happens here suddenly in Judaism, Christianity, Islam, is it's one God, it's a male God, there's no women, and then you look at how the authority structures of those particular religions are set up. Then you look at how the cultures that grow out of those religions are set up, and you look at what we're dealing with today Stephen Schwartz, who's been a guest on the show, he really says that what he sees when he looks at, you know, the worst of religious intolerance and fundamentalism in the U.S., he says the most striking thing is the attitude toward women, that as much as anything else, it's about suppressing women. So speak a bit about that.
Well, yeah, it's not an accident that we... This is the only culture, as you said, in the ancient world where you didn't have gods and goddesses. And, you know, it's no accident that everything is written for the benefit of men and by them. The same is true of Islam, you know. I mean, so much of what's in Islamic law is about how to control women and how to keep them in their place. And same is true of Jewish law. So, you know, it's quite fascinating. It's no accident that our culture grew up that way.
Right.
And what you find, but suddenly I thought, wait a minute, these secret sources that I'm working on, these gospels, the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Philip and the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, these texts that the bishops hated are full of, you know, speaking about God in feminine form as well as masculine form, as father and as mother, for example, speaking about women who are disciples of Jesus and equal with the men, and it makes the men disciples angry, in fact. and they speak about a divine being when the Lord says, I am God and there is none other beside me. And then his mother says, wait a minute, Sabaoth, don't tell lies. And that's wisdom talking from way above him, saying, wait a minute, just stop that. And everybody at the conference roared laughing at this dialogue that I was reading from these ancient texts.
And as you point out, this
has huge cultural impact. This is already a protest 2,000 years ago.
Right. This conference you were at was in the early days of feminism, and it was like, you know, to find out, oh, another thing they kept from us, you know.
Yes, it was fascinating. What else didn't we know about the early
exactly.
Christian movement?
So one thing I wanted,
the answer is a lot.
Yes. One thing I wanted to jump to, just because, although, you know, to many familiar with your work, these secret gospels, these scrolls, are, you know, people know that story, but a lot of listeners probably don't. So just to give people, I want to establish the role of the Nag Hammadi scrolls in terms of what we know about Christ, the Gospels, the Church, the story of their why they were hidden, how they were discovered, and one thing, and you can also weave it into your story, because it strikes me, you were choosing at that moment, at the moment that you chose to go to Harvard Divinity School, you were choosing, and you make it clear in the book, among five different, quite interesting graduate programs and graduate things you might study, which shows you were not, you know, at that moment, at that moment, that turning point in your life, you weren't, you know, the religion wasn't the only thing you would ever study. No, you were, and yet you chose that one, and it was only after you arrived there that you realized that Harvard was one of the two institutions, I think, at that point, that was actually researching these gospels. It was a complete new thing to you and became, I mean, that's the fork in your life, right?
It is. I mean, you're right. I thought, well, there's so many things I'm interested in. I wanted to be a professional dancer, in modern dance, and that didn't quite work. So I was trying to figure out Plan B, and I thought, well, art history is fascinating, and NYU, there's a really interesting person teaching it. I applied to Brandeis in a different field, social thought at Chicago, and whatever. But there were questions I had about Christianity, just because that was a tradition I grew up with, and had not engaged much until I was 14 and accidentally went to a Billy Graham crusade, of all things, and got born again, and I just totally loved it for about a year, and then I fell out of love with it. And later I thought, wait a minute, what was it about that was powerful?
You know,
was
let me,
it Christianity,
let me...
or was it any religion? Or
you know that you share that sort of experience with Reza Aslan. Do you know that?
No, I've never talked with Reza about that. I knew he was an evangelical Christian for
a while. Well, as a teenager, He went to, his family, when they moved from Iran, moved to Enid, Oklahoma. Not exactly where you'd.
That's a culture shift.
Yeah, and except maybe for the terrain. The terrain might be similar. But he ended up going with some friends to a revival service and was intoxicated just as you were as a teenager. And that's why he spent a few years as a born-again Christian, just as you spent, I guess it was a year or two.
1 year. And you know, that's a great age to get converted, because the idea that, the book, I have to say, even though I like to come at the study of religion sort of pretending I'm an anthropologist or something, like Clifford Geertz writing on religion as a cultural system, because that's one way I look at it. But it's also a spiritual search, as was his. And I think anybody who really writes with passion, whether it's about Shakespeare or, you know, the movies or politics, has very personal agendas. But you're right to say, I got to graduate school thinking, how did this Jesus thing start anyway? What do we know about Jesus? And the answer is not much. But they just discovered, in 1945, somebody discovered a whole library of secret texts and gospels, most of them attributed to Jesus and his disciples, in Upper Egypt. They were found in a cave, hidden in a monastery, because the bishops wanted them all burned. And suddenly, instead of having four gospels, which are in the New Testament, we have a lot more, and many other things that are the secret teachings which the bishops didn't want anybody to know about. And I love these texts. I started reading the Gospel of Thomas, which is just a list of sayings of Jesus. And one of the things I always think of is a saying in which Jesus says, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. And I thought, hey, you don't have to believe that. It just happens to be true.
That's right. That's right. That is not a religious concept. It's not a belief that you have to subscribe to. It is a fact of life.
It's a saying about how we experience reality.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be hints about sort of koans, as they are in Buddhist tradition.
And one thing, let me ask you, since you just brought up that quote, which I first learned from your book, it was Beyond Belief, right? The Gospel of Thomas?
Yeah.
That I first learned, but it's become one of those quotes that I'll send to people on their birthday, or you know what I mean? It's like it's...
That's why I wrote the book, The Gnostic Gospels, because I thought, wow.
Yeah, this is...
I have to write about this stuff, because this is really fascinating.
But just, again, to sort of... Because one of the things we're bouncing back and forth around here is this mix between scholarship and personal experience and so on. And you say that quote struck you first as human philosophy, and later you saw it as having a religious role to play as well. Can you talk about that? Just because I think it's
sure.
Interesting.
I mean, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. It's like a psychological statement, you know, like people who keep everything hidden is inside. And pretty much I was brought up to not say what I thought.
Right.
So bringing forth what's within you, that's finding your own voice.
Yeah.
And so I just took it that way. It's about dealing with your reality and not keeping it suppressed. But later I realized that what this text is also saying is saying that what's within each person is a kind of energy that comes from a divine source, and that you can find your way to that source within yourself. You don't need a church, you don't need a Buddha, you don't need Jesus. They're just catalysts for what you can discover on your own. And so this is a very different kind of message. In fact, Terrence was teaching with a colleague. His name is Jonathan Gold, and he's a specialist on Tibetan Buddhism. So I suggested we do a course together called Jesus and Buddha.
Mm.
And we did it. We had hundreds of students. It was great. And I started to learn things about Buddhism, and he started to learn things about Christianity, and similarities and differences. So that was really fun.
Yeah. Let me just tell people that we're about the halfway point. This is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Elaine Pagels, award-winning author of the Gnostic Gospels and a number of other notable and best-selling books. And we're talking about her newest book, Why Religion? A Personal Story. And you can learn more about Elaine's work at elaine-pagels.com, elaine-pagels.com. Let me see. So I cut you off. Well, we've been bouncing so much. I cut you off a bit in this story of the scrolls. So the scrolls, why were, and one of the things, by the way, the first book of yours I read was Adam, Eve, and the Serpent. And
it's subtitled as Sex and Politics in Early Christianity.
Yeah, and but it was so there was so much in it that was new to me and exciting to me. And for anyone who hasn't heard of it or hasn't read it, I highly recommend it because what it ends up being about also, I would say, and it's funny how we take our own, you know, interpretations. In other words, sex and politics, yes. I think the most profound thing for me in the book was our relationship to nature and the natural world.
Yes, that's really important.
You know, which of course nowadays is you know, life and death in a way, perhaps, facing climate change and destruction of all the, you know, species and systems and so on. But that book says how there was a turning point. But one of the things that you told me that in that book that I hadn't quite realized was Christianity for the first 300 years or so with these secret texts was the a religion of truth seekers, of outsiders, of troublemakers. And then when Constantine converts, it becomes the state religion. And at that point is when the creed, the Nicene Creed, is developed at the Council of Nicaea to tell people this is what you have to agree that you believe if you are a Christian, and that's when it comes down to just those four Gospels and the others are taken away, correct?
Yes. I mean, it's not that all other Christians had this other forms of Christianity. It's just that there were many ways people interpreted Jesus and the message of Jesus, and I really love the way the Gospel of Thomas does it, as a kind of person who has discovered this the inner source of connection with the divine source. It's a beautiful text. It's some people think it's very much like a Buddhist text.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually probably influenced by Jewish mystical thought because it's. It really has deep affinities with what much later, 1,000 years later, will become Kabbalah.
Yeah.
But I love these texts. But as you said, when, you know, Christianity was a persecuted religion at the time, and completely, you know, people were getting thrown to the lions, literally. But when the emperor converted, or future emperor, Constantine, he wanted the whole empire to become Christian and not worship the gods of Greece and Rome anymore. So he called these Christians together and said, okay, just write down a bunch of what Christians have to believe. You know, I believe in one God, Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, blah, 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 blah. And one Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, that whole thing. That's what they said. This is Christian, okay? You sign it and you're in.
Yeah.
If you don't sign it, you're out. And you not only out of the church, but you go into the depth of hell and the fires of damnation. That's what many did believe. And they turned the Christian movement into a set of doctrines and dogmas. I find that really unfortunate. I mean, it works well as an institution.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work well for an understanding of reality, I don't think.
Yeah, and for, I think for people who, for, like for me when I first read that in that book, that's such a shift of how we've seen things. In other words, I was brought up Catholic. And so the Pope, the authority, the creed.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, I will share something personally, which is that many in my family, or about half my family, large Irish Catholic family, still attend church. And when I would visit my family, I would attend church with them. And I found that becoming more and more difficult because of the creed. There would be this moment in the service when everyone would, you know, stand up and repeat these things. And I realized, no, I don't believe that one. I don't believe that one. And I can't
believe Jesus was born of a virgin.
Yeah, right. And it made it for me, because I said, I'm not going to stand here and fake it. It made it more difficult for me. I mean, I still will make exceptions, but it was an interesting moment when I realized, wait a minute, you know, that creed is not my creed. And here, you know, the crowd is saying it's what we believe, and it wasn't for me.
Exactly, Terrence. I feel that a lot of people who are raised that way, and it's not just Catholicism, it's Lutheranism, it's Episcopalianism, out of simple honesty, they say, hey, I don't believe all that stuff. And then they just, you know, leave the whole thing behind.
Mm.
And now I think that's for some people, that's a loss. It would be a loss for me, because I love the liturgy. I love the stories. There's a lot, the music. There's much that I love. I happen to go sometimes to an Episcopal church here with a priest who said once, you know, I'd rather say the 23rd Psalm than the Creed.
Mm.
And somebody reported him to the bishop for heresy.
Oh, my God.
And I totally agree with him.
Oh, yeah.
The 23rd Psalm would be a lot better.
And the Sermon on the Mount is like, you know, that works for me really well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, some of this tradition, that's when I had to figure out, as you did, what part of this tradition would you throw away and what part would you keep?
Mm-hmm. Let's go. I want to go to the what is in some sense the heart of the book, which is how you tell the story of your very secular upbringing, and then this as I call it this intoxication with evangelical Christianity, at least as Billy Graham portrayed it, and you said how you know suddenly religion opened your imagination, invited your passions, things that you hadn't seen before, when basically Christianity meant be nice to people. And then, you know, there's a poignant moment of why you leave the evangelical church. And I mean, I will say it so that we don't, just because for the sake of time, but someone close to you dies, and they say, I think it's just as well he wasn't going to go to heaven anyway, or something like that, right?
This was a high school friend of mine. It was an automobile accident. You know, kids driving 100 miles an hour. And he was killed in a crash. He was 16 years old. And I went back to this evangelical church, which I joined about a year before. And I was sort of, you know, a participant in this. And they said, oh, that's terrible, your friend killed in the crash. Was he born again? And I said, no, he was Jewish. And they said, well, then he's in hell.
Yeah.
And I was so shocked. I said, what? I mean, wasn't Jesus Jewish? What are you talking about? That has nothing to do with the God of love that you're talking about.
Yeah.
But I just was, frankly, numb. I mean, I just walked out of that church alone and feeling desolated, and I never went back.
Right. And then you tell how, you know, you still have your questions about religion. You still wonder about the role. But then, as I was going to say, sort of the heart of the book is what religion or religious moments or what might be called religious experiences happen to you when you are dealing with the two deaths that befell you 25 years ago. Can you talk to the heart of that?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I was actually sitting down and talking with a good friend who's a poet, because I was using a poem of hers in my class. It was about the angel Gabriel appearing to Mary, and this young woman has the sense of an overpowering sense of love coming toward her. And I said, well, hey, this is Marie Howe. She's a fine poet. I said, Marie, how did you write that poem? And she said, oh, well, she's raised Catholic too. She said, well, something like that happened to me. I just had this strange sense that I was loved. It was just a moment of amazement. She said, but of course I couldn't say it was about me. And I said, why not? And she said, that's the last taboo.
Mm-hmm.
People could write about sex or money or almost anything, but you can't say I had a religious experience.
Mm.
But she had had something that felt like that to her. And she's not particularly religious either now. But she has experience. People have experiences, you know, they can't explain sometimes. And I thought, wow, I'm going to write about those. Because people do have experiences. In fact, recently I was at Esalen, and there was a meeting called Experiences I Can't Explain, and there were psychiatrists and UFO people and poets and all kinds of people talking about experiences I can't explain. We didn't have any answers about how those things happened, but they did happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some of them. I don't know what to make of them. But I thought I'd write about them because I think those are the kinds of sources from which these traditions originally grew.
One of the things you talk about that befell you and I think may be very much the norm on a deep level, perhaps culturally, perhaps deeper than that, was that when these deaths happen and you are in intense suffering, it is difficult not to link your suffering to guilt.
Well, yeah, because, you know, that's part of the culture, Terrence, and it's a terrible part. When somebody dies, right, or when somebody's sitting in the emergency room and someone you love is critically injured or something, you know, people will say, well, why him?
Yeah.
Or why her? Or why did this happen? Yeah. Why did it happen to that person? I mean, such a good person.
Right.
You know, as though that doesn't make any sense, you know. It might make sense if you feel they deserved it.
Right.
Or if, you know, if somebody has been smoking five packs
right.
of cigarettes
right.
for 40 years
yeah.
and they get lung cancer, you sort of think, well, you know, they should have known. But if something right out of the blue, like my friend suddenly in an accident, he's dead, you feel, why? How could that happen? Because the culture teaches us, Adam and Eve's story teaches us.
That's
why
right.
Why do people die anyway, Terrence? Why do they die? Genesis says we wouldn't die,
That's
we
right.
wouldn't have pain, we wouldn't suffer oppression, we wouldn't hurt if somebody hadn't sinned, right?
Yeah. Well, and Augustine certainly made, you know, made put that front and center.
Well, yeah. I mean, he basically says Adam sinned and that's why we die. And Jewish tradition says that too. Why do women walk at the head of the funeral procession? Because they brought sin into the world and they're responsible for all this. So that's not an original thought. But the idea of pain and suffering is linked to guilt. As one anthropologist said, suffering feels like punishment.
Yes,
so
yes.
So if somebody gets a terrible illness, you think, well, did they bring it on themselves by bad thoughts? Or, you know, there's a lot of people in this culture will say, well, you know, you could have avoided it by thinking positively or something, or just living better or something. And actually, so when my son was diagnosed, our son was diagnosed, and we had adored this beautiful child, wonderful child.
That you'd had trouble having.
We adored
him, it took
and
you
he was
a long
diagnosed
time to
with
have.
A horrendous
yeah.
and very unusual illness called pulmonary hypertension. And that's what happens when you see an athlete, say, 20 years old, suddenly on the football field has a heart attack. You say, why does that person have a heart attack? Well, they'd have an undiagnosed case of pulmonary hypertension, which,
right.
in which the lungs just become impermeable to oxygen, and they die of a heart attack at the age of 20 or at the age of 5 or 6. And that's what we were told would happen to our son, and nobody knows why it happens. I mean, it's not genetic. It's just, hey, it's out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're a parent and you have a child who dies for whatever reason, you're probably going to blame yourself.
Yeah.
Or you're going to say, why did I let him take the car that night?
Mm-hmm.
Or why did I let her get on the airplane, you know, when it crashed? I should have, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
We say that because I discovered myself the hard way that I would rather feel guilty than to feel the real feeling. And so I thought, so what's the real feeling that's worse than guilt? And the real feeling for me was, you're helpless. There's nothing
yes.
you can do.
Right. Rather than
there's nothing you can do.
Rather than accepting that we have no control, that
yes.
in this most meaningful thing, we actually have no agency, that we've worked so hard to cultivate and so hard to build up. And what you're saying is that we cannot face. And so we go to guilt instead.
Guilt is preferable.
Yes.
Isn't that weird?
Yes.
It feels better to feel that you have some agency, even if it's negative.
That's right.
Than to say, especially if you're something wrong with a child. I was reading a psychologist paper at the time, and the psychologist said if there's something, if the child has a difficulty, if a child has an emotional or physical or mental disability, the mother will feel guilty. She'll think it's her fault, and she'll beat herself up for it. The father may, but not as much, because I guess the woman gives birth to the child.
Mm.
So that's just the way it works
yeah.
in our culture,
yeah.
and actually in many cultures. So that guilt is something that makes grief much harder. If you think it's not only you've lost somebody
right.
you adore, but you think it's your fault.
Now, having kind of realized and seen that connection and begun to maybe find your way out of it, which out of it means you have to accept the lack of control.
Which is scary.
Now, did religious thought, religious anything play a role in that, or was it, or in that one, is it just that religion has tapped into that suffering equals guilt and...
Well, you know, the Bible teaches you that. I mean, I was reading the story of David and Bathsheba, you know, the woman
oh, yeah.
Husband he had killed in the war so that he could marry this woman who was married to somebody else. David arranged for her husband to be right in the middle of the fighting, and he got killed. And then he had this sexual relationship with Bathsheba before they got married. And it says, and they had, she got pregnant and had a baby boy, and it says, and the Lord smote the child because of their illicit sexual connection. So if the baby dies, somebody did something wrong.
Right. And the whole Sodom
and
Gomorrah.
Jewish tradition,
right?
Too.
Sodom and Gomorrah is basically that thing writ large. This town suffers because they were immoral. And it's the same thing that we see nowadays
yes.
or, you know, current times when 9/11 happens and some evangelical fundamentalists blame it on homosexuality.
Yes, we're being punished for the sin of homosexuality. Absolutely. And you know, somebody has to be guilty.
Yeah.
So that's just what the Bible teaches.
Right.
You know? So I had to unlearn it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we'd be better off unlearning it. I mean, you know, there's a purpose for guilt. If you harm somebody seriously, if you rape or kill or violate somebody, then guilt is appropriate, you know, because it can motivate you to make amends or confess or
right.
try to make it up.
Yeah, somehow move toward justice. Yeah.
Guilt is important.
Right.
But we're talking about the cases where you have no input. You
yeah.
didn't do that.
Right.
You didn't do anything wrong with this person by letting that person say get on that airplane when
yeah.
it crashed.
Yeah.
It's you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I just remember when I was a child, if I got hurt, broke my arm playing football, got a terrible, you know, gash riding my bike, my first thought was that I'm in trouble, not that I'm in pain.
Yeah.
And I just feel like I was internalizing that same syndrome. Let me talk about another often religious concept that I think also comes up for you in this process over the years, and that's grace.
Yes.
Can you talk about grace?
Well, you know, I've thought a lot about, Terrence, about the fact that, you know, everybody's life, everybody seems to me, I don't think anyone gets out of this life without serious challenges and difficulties. And some people get depressed and just go down, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
One way or the other. And some people don't. And I thought, you know, I had some to deal with some blows. I thought if anyone had told me in advance that I'd have to deal with those things, I just would have. I don't know if I wouldn't have wanted to live through it, frankly.
Right.
And I wasn't sure at times when they happened whether I did want to live through it. But I also didn't want to spend my life depressed and go, you know,
yeah,
in despair.
And so you had children. You had children who needed you.
What? Yeah, I had these children who are now fine.
Yeah.
And so I think also these traditions, we've talked about some of the liabilities in them, and I think it's really important to be aware of them if you're affected by them, as a lot of us are. But one of the positive things to say about them is that they're supposed to move you toward hope. It's like people go to these rituals at crucial times, like birth, adolescence, you know, the union of people and marriage, death, and they're supposed to help you through, you know, challenging transitions. In a way that has affirmation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And joy, actually. So, I think they do that, and they do tell different stories. They speak to our imagination differently. I mean, for example, we know we're going to die, and I'm not sure that I believe in the afterlife as it's pictured, you know, with all the angels and stuff like that. I don't know what I believe about that. I don't really have any belief. I don't know what to think. But I would rather imagine, you know, that I'll see those people again. I'd rather think that it's that one just joins into a joyful harmony with the universe from which we came or whatever, to see it not as a total annihilation and cause for complete lament, but this is just what happens to human beings, and it's you know, like every other transition. I don't mean it's like every other transition, but you know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
It's not a punishment,
right.
And it's not a terrible thing. It's just human nature.
Right, right. You know, it's interesting. When we often hear why religion emerged in the first place, and I think people say it's to give some sort of explanation or meaning to the incomprehensible, like death. And I think I always thought that it was like the fact that we're going to die, and obviously it is. In other words, you make up this whole structure so that your death may be... But it struck me, reading your book, of course, that it's really perhaps more tangible about dealing with the deaths of others.
Well, I think that may be, yeah, because... Interesting. It may be, which is very hard to deal with. You know, some people can't tolerate the losses they suffer, and I had no illusions that I'd had the worst of it. I mean,
yeah,
there are many people who lose people they love, even their own lives, by violence, and I think that's much worse than accident or illness.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody'd intended...
Right.
The death of my child or my husband, I can't even tell you how I'd feel.
Yeah.
And that many people have to deal with that. That's the other thing that I felt was really significant for me, that people say, well, you know, some people act like you should find some kind of deep spiritual lesson, like, oh, my goodness, you went through this, and you must have some profound wisdom, and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, hey, you think the loss of my son is worth any wisdom that I should have,
yes,
fractional as it might be anyway?
No, I'll tell you one thing that comes...
No, I'd rather have that child than any sort of spiritual lesson in the universe. We
quote
don't
of
find
your...
meaning. We create meaning.
That's right. You repeat that quote of Heinz, your husband, who said, "I would have given my life for that child, but no one would take it."
Yes, but you see, there are people who do find meaning. For example, Terrence, we all remember what happened at Parkland, this horrible shooting at the high school, among others.
Right.
And you remember how you or I mean, I certainly watched those children on television, you know, in that demonstration, speak about it. Oh, it was riveting. It was fabulous. It was inspiring. I mean, they still suffer those losses, no doubt, and the trauma of seeing your classmates come down in a school. Who can imagine it? But they did something amazing. They gave it meaning. I don't think it has meaning intrinsically that some deranged, raging person killed those children. But they are trying to make out of it something which can prevent horrors like that from happening to other people. And that is very powerful.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean by create meaning.
Yes, yes. So,
and people do that all the time.
Yeah, and by the way, the at least one, I don't know if it's both houses of Congress, but at least one House of Congress just passed universal background checks, which has, it's the most significant gun legislation in 2-3 decades. And I would link it directly to the kids at Parkland. We've got to wrap this up. Thank you so much, both for writing the book and then for our time together today. The book is Why Religion, A Personal Story, and Elaine's website is elaine-pagels.com. For this conversation and many others, articles, transcripts, and so on, join me in pursuit of a world that just might work. Go to terrencemcnally.net or worldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. You can get a weekly email announcement, which tells you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, plus usually 8 or 9 articles that I choose to sort of flesh out the context of the conversation. Sign up at my site or email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes, Apple Podcasts. You can find years of podcasts at my site, or at iTunes, or at several other, you know, websites, Podomatic.com. And you'll find Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, etc. Thanks to Mark Maxwell and Ricky Herrera in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, Elaine Pagels, thank you, and keep up your good work.
Thank you. It's been wonderful talking with you.